Okay, how's it going, party people in the place to be? This is Nerds from the Underground. I'm Johnny from Graphic Vandalism, and joining me is
Chris, what up, everybody?
and we got a couple of really, really awesome fun books for you. Books that we both love. What we got on the table tonight, Chris?
Right, so we got Death Orb, and you'll come in as you'll give us the what that's about in the creative team. And also we've got Bitter Root.
Amen to that. And yeah, Death Orb is written by Ryan Ferrier with pencils by Alejandro Aragon. It's got inks by Chris Holleran, O'Holleran, and lettering by Ryan Ferrier actually does the lettering. And oh, actually, Chris O'Holleran does the coloring. Alejandro does both the drawing and the ink. So that's pretty gangster. And the Explore, an American wasteland full of strange science, mutant biker gangs, mysterious death cults, determined to rebuild the world in their image. An axe-wielding warrior chops a righteous path through biker assassins and mech-suited mutants in a desperate search for his abducted wife and son. A mix between Akira and Mad Max Fury Road with hints of the Terminator, brought to you by Alejandro Aragon, artist of 28 Days Later and RoboCop, and Ryan Ferrier, author of Dave, TMNT New Universe, and Kong on the Planet of the Apes.
So the first thing I want to say about the book is when you were reading the creative team, the writer is the letterer as well. And outside of books that were like made by one person, I don't know that I've ever seen that.
Yeah, no, that's actually a really good point. Yeah, aside from like the books that are like, like Usagi Yojimbo by like Stan Saki, where he does everything, you don't usually see the guy who writes the book lettering it. Usually, most of the time when I read comics, Clem Robbins does the letters. I mean, like that dude letters virually every book I read. So it's kind of odd to not say his name for once when I'm talking about a book. But yeah, that is a pretty interesting thing. And also, like
Yeah.
one, another thing that really got me about this creative team is Alejandro Aragon. Like, he is really becoming one of my favorite names. This trade came out right after Adrian Wassell sent me issue 2 of Revenant to read, and I was already blown. This guy was already blowing my brain up. I was already in love with his art, and then this book came out, and it just elevated it so much more. Because, I mean, you can attest to this. The action set pieces in this book are just glorious, right?
Yeah, it's got like this kind of like frenetic type movement going on. Like anytime you see, especially the ninja dude, like when you see his movements, like jumping around and everything, the pencil is just going all crazy. I love it.
Yeah, it's got his motion has a very kinetic feel to it, very organic movements too. Like it looks kind of like how you'd expect to, like, if you're like looking through anime and you just like stop at a certain panel or whatever, I guess slide, and like that's how
Like
you'd
you
see
just
like it
pause
in
it.
yeah in mid motion, and that's what his panels look like. It's and the ninja steals the show in this book. Lots of great characters, but man, the ninja is just awesome in this book.
Like he's like that's easily probably my favorite character. Like the whole time he's like tripping, right? Like he's got like this PTSD thing going on where he's thinking about where he came from. Like visions and all types of stuff like that, and he's just bugged out. I love it.
Well, it's almost like he sees things in a kind of odd, paranoid way, but at the same time, he sees it a little clearer than everybody else. Like he saw the biker for what he truly was. The biker kind of fooled everybody else, but the ninja knew what the biker was all about from the get-go. Which, if you listen to his description of him when he comes through and he's telling the little girl what he sees, like that's basically the biker for you. Even though he's not as bad as the other villains in the book, he's not a good guy. Which really, I love books like this because your heroes are dastardly bastards, and you got, oh yeah, and the bad guys are even just so disgusting. Like the bad guy's power trip in this is just. Like so anime, like honestly, like you gotta Ryan Ferrier has to be almost as big of a weeb as I am, I swear to God, to have a villain like this in a book.
And I think too, and you could tell me your thoughts on this. Like you told in the beginning, you said like the influences, like it's like Mad Max, Akira. I agree with that too. but it also has a feel of like a 90s book. Like the way he was dressed, like with the goggles and the jacket he had on doing Papa Willie's on the motorcycle, like it gave me that kind of feel too.
Yeah, definitely like 90s bad girl, bad boy comics from early Image, and there's a lot of late 80s trash cinema thrown in there as well. Stuff like Megaforce and like really kind of odd obscure movies that you don't see very often, but if they're big in the cult scene, like Cherry 2000, those are kind of referenced here too, kind of subtly. And then there, I also with some of the horror and gore scenes and the coloring in them, I get flashes of 70s Italian horror. There's some giallo stuff kind of going on, Suspiria type horror scenes every now and then thrown in, which I thought was kind of a neat little influence as well.
Right. Overall, well, as we said in the beginning, I think the art by itself is worth the price of admission. Outside the art, the story was pretty good too. I have some problems with the ending, but overall, like, it has some pretty good scenes, like when they're stuck in the bunker and they're coming out and they've got to fight those guys. The little, like, the banter between the group of rebels, like, I really like that. The main bad guy to me wasn't as interesting as the bounty hunter. I think his name is Black Shark. Like, he was definitely, to me, the most interesting. And I can't really say he's a bad guy, but I guess he plays as an antagonist of sorts in this story.
Right.
So the characters, for me, the plot wasn't as strong, but the art, the characters definitely pushed it along so that I didn't mind, like, you know, the plot not being there.
Right. Well, that's how these breakneck books kind of are. Like, Cemetery Beach by Ellis is kind of the same way. It's very heavy on the action, and there's very little story. The only difference between this book and that one is I'll agree with you that they kind of left a little too much to finish up in the last two issues. So, like, the fight between the biker and the bounty hunter wasn't as epic as you were hoping, because, like, you had this kind of cat-and-mouse game being played through some issues, and then when they finally catch up, it was a little rushed. It wasn't completely, but I would have liked to have seen maybe an issue more of this so they could have maybe flushed out the end fights a little better. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And also, like, I'm not really big on exposition. Like, I don't mind picking up a comic and not being told, you know, everything that's going on. I don't mind things being left up to interpretation either, but there was a lot of stuff regarding, I guess, the villains. I guess they call him Father. Like, there was a lot of stuff about, like, his goals that were kind of left on the table that I wish I knew more about, because the premise of it and the setup to it was very good. But I don't know, maybe I missed it, but so maybe you could explain. But, like, when the actual Death Orb, do they really ever explain or get into detail what it was?
No, but the thing about that is it's what they were homaging. See, the whole book is an homage to those 70s films like Mad Max, where the bad guys had, like, these big goofy aspirations that you never really understood what they were, and there was always, like, this big thing that they had to find and they fought over. It was never really defined what it actually did.
Okay.
And they were kind of playing with that, but also, if you remember, the biker didn't complete his mission.
Right, he didn't.
He helped the rebels with what they needed help with. So I'm thinking that if we help get this book more buzz, like I did with, as I'm covering this book everywhere I can because I love it, and I hope that maybe Ryan and Alejandro could, like, throw us another arc of this and maybe kind of explain a little bit more of this and kind of give us another really rad sequel full of odd, quirky characters. I could really be into that.
No, absolutely. That would be... That's actually, to me, probably the perfect idea for a sequel. Is, like, imagine the main character, the biker, teaming up with the Black Shark in the next arc or something like that. Like, that would be dope.
Hell yeah. Yeah, then that's one of the good things about, like, the old goofy sequels to old kind of trash cinema post-apocalyptic films is like you would have things like that where the bad guy of the first film would be friends with the hero in the second one. So yeah, that would be actually be really cool if they pulled that off. Like I really really love this book and I really hope they do more. Like
yeah.
I'm a big fan of Dark Horse and they've kind of been slipping. They kind of lost a lot of their best books, so like stuff like this could really help them. Like kind of rebuild because they lost Star Wars, they lost Conan, Hellboy just finished up. So yeah, they're gonna need a couple more hits than Black Hammer to kind of keep them on the map.
Right. I enjoyed it. You know, for what it was, I definitely enjoyed it, and I would not mind seeing more. Like if a volume 2 or more issues come out, then it would definitely be on my radar to pick up. Because as you said, like the things that drive it forward are done so great that you don't mind not having all the plot and things like that, story details, like just the action, just the whacked out characters, all make it worth it for me. So if there was more, I'd definitely read it.
Yeah, they could actually develop a universe for this, and I'd be totally into it.
You know, like. Cause there's I don't know if you play like video games that much. You ever play Borderlands?
Oh yeah, that's actually I only played the second one, and not too much because that's a game that you need to have more than one player, and I'm kind of a one player guy. But
right.
I enjoyed what I played of it. I loved the art style of it. Beautiful, beautiful
like,
looking game.
It gave me those kind of vibes too. You know, like.
Oh yeah, definitely. That was definitely inspired by the same stuff this comic was.
Right. I gotta go back. You gotta give me some suggestions. Go back, watch some of that stuff. I've seen Mad Max, I've seen the first one. I've also seen Fury Road from a few years ago. Those were both great.
Oh, well, there's like Strider. There's like so many Mad Max ripoffs. Bronx Warrior. For anime, dude, if you haven't watched Fist of the North Star,
yeah, yep,
like
that's Mad Max. He just dressed like him too.
Yeah, that's Bruce Lee as Mad Max is how I've always seen it. Yeah, that's great place to start for anybody who's listening. That you know, if you like anime and you want to see something that's just total Mad Max badass, get into Fist of the North Star, man. Yeah. Kenshiro will poke you in the head and make your head explode.
I love that anime. They're all like Nani.
I love when he goes all crazy with the yee, gummy 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 noise, man. When he's doing his mad attacks, where it's like making the guy's fat belly spin, and he's doing, "Yee, gummy, 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 gummy."
He's so ridiculously strong, right? Like, and the main character of this comic is so ridiculously strong too.
Yeah, in his own way, he's not like
it's not Kenshiro level, but like anyone who pretty much stepped to him for the most part, like he was doing some crazy stuff, like when he jumped off the motorcycle. And
yeah,
and like
flew over the car and shot people. Yeah.
You know what else I noticed too, and I don't know if this is a trope, I guess, but it's not something that I've noticed until this year. Is that having like the head, like traveling with the head of the enemy because it's talking to you or whatever? Because that was a major plot point of I think The Last Knight on Earth.
Oh, you're right. Yeah.
Like, I don't know which one came out on. I don't know which one came out first, but it reminded me of that.
This one technically came out first. This one's actually, I think, started. The first issue, I think, came out at the end of last year, and I think Last Knight on Earth started, I don't know, like, what, 3 months ago?
Right, so something about that.
But, I mean, I don't know which one was in production first, you know what I mean? Like. But they're both wonderful comics. Mm-hmm. Like if you want to read a Batman comic that sounds like what we just talked about, yeah, go check out Snyder and Capullo's Last Knight on Earth. That is one interesting, fun, messed up Batman book. I don't really like Batman too often, but that book rocks. So yeah, good. Thanks for bringing that one up too.
It reminded me because he walks around with the head of the Joker, right? Like he talks to him and things like that. And then this guy was walking around with the head of that blind dude. And he was saying he talks to him. I just something I noticed.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, I didn't put that together. But I'm trying to think. I can't think of anything else where I've seen that actually done though. Like maybe in Yeah, no, I can't think of.
Yeah, that's what. Because the first thing I thought was, I wonder if they were both like inspired by the same thing. Like, if this is a, you know, a trope from those kind of movies or whatever. And I'm like, maybe, you know.
Yeah, not one that's maybe springing into my mind. Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. Both books are good though, like you said. So.
Yeah, and both got wonderful art too.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to get into Bitterroot?
Yeah, let's get into it.
All right. Next up, we have Bitterroot, written by David F. Walker and Chuck Brown, with just beautiful, beautiful work art by Rico Rinzi and Sanford Green, letters by Clayton Cowles, and cover art by Sanford Green, and edited by Heather Antos. Okay, once the Sangres were known as the greatest monster hunting family of all time. Their speciality? Curing the souls of those infected by hate. Now those days are fading. A terrible tragedy has claimed most of the family, and remaining cousins find themselves divided by their methods. But with a new breed of monster loose on the streets of Harlan, the Sangre family will have to come together to stop it or watch the human race fall to untold evil.
Awesome. So this book was just recently nominated, I think, for an Eisner for Best New Series, which is a well-deserved nomination because the book is really good. When it first came out, I think I had it all wrong about like what it was going to be about. Like, I thought it was just going to be kind of this sci-fi like monster type thing, which it is. But at the same time, there's much deeper themes to it, you know?
Right, right. There's really good civil rights messages mm-hmm. worked into it.
Yeah, so that part I wasn't expecting. So when I picked it up, I'm like, oh yeah, it's going to be cool, like fighting some monsters, things like that. But it really started getting deep into, those kinds of things. So for those who don't know, like you just heard the description of the book, it takes place during the Harlem Renaissance, which was a very, very racially charged moment in time. And it kind of... I don't know. I don't really know how to explain how to go about it, but pretty much the monsters are kind of, I guess, metaphors for the hatred of the time, you know? And it gets into a pretty complicated discussion on race, which and at the same time keeps it fun with the monsters, and there's all types of family dynamics, which are interesting too. But overall, the book was good.
Oh yeah, no. Like I was excited for this. The first thing I saw was a variant cover for the second issue that Mike Mignola drew, and I'm a huge Hellboy fan. So the Mike Mignola doing the cover for an adjacent horror series, that always gets me excited. And then I got into what it was about, and then I saw Sanford Green was doing the art for it, and oh my god, dude, like Sanford Green is so good. I'm happy that this book is finally getting him the credit he deserves. I've loved his art since seeing Rotten Apple in Dark Horse Presents years ago.
Yeah. You just recommended that book to me.
Yeah, since then, like, I've just been waiting for his day to come, and it finally has. He should be up for an Eisner for Best Artist of a New Series, in my opinion. And one thing I liked about this book, too, is I like the way it injected the sexism into the story as well, which is kind of a thing that you don't really get in woke stories like this. Usually you get I don't want to seem... Usually you either get like the narrative for the people of color or the narrative for women. But this one you get kind of both, because the character Blink is just a badass. But she gets held back through most of the book until she's finally like, you know what, man, these Jinyu are screwing everything up. Give me my stick. I'm going to go and whoop some Jinyu ass. And she is the toughest of the Sangre family. And she's my favorite character in the book. She's just totally a hero. So I found that was pretty interesting for the book. I thought that was a neat way to take it as well.
Yeah, no, I second that, because Blink is probably my favorite character too. And you definitely kind of get that dual oppression that she suffers from, right? Like, she suffers from the hatred and all of the racism, and she also suffers from oppression within her own family, right? Like, she wants to be out and fight, like, and do the things that she, you know, that she's good at. But her family is telling her, like, you know, that's not her duty. You have to do what all the other women in our family did. And, you know, what's really interesting is kind of the, what's the word for it? Just the comparing between her and the other character, Cullen, because he doesn't want to fight, but they make him fight.
Right, yeah. He reminds me of a character that would be played by Mike Epps.
Yeah.
Day-Day from Friday movies.
Like, the juxtaposition, that's the word I was looking for. The juxtaposition between the two of them, where she wants to fight but is not allowed, and he doesn't want to fight but is forced because he's a man. So you kind of get that. Towards the end, though, his character arc seems to change, and you know what I'm talking about with that. But overall, yeah. And then on top of that, now I have these books in issues, so I don't actually have the trade. I don't know if you have the trade, but in the trade, do they have at the back the essays and things like that?
Oh yeah, this one actually hooks you up. You get all of the four the prologues. You get the Bitter Truths. You get all the different sketches and the awesome Bitterroot Akira cover.
Mm.
But yeah, the essays that really helps you dig in and really understand, if you couldn't already, what this creative team was trying to say with this book. And I like the extra effort, but I understood right away,
right,
as I'm a big fan of history and looking back at the awful things that happened in time. And I think that this book actually gives the bad side of history a better look than it deserves,
yeah,
to tell you the truth. There's that one cop that's actually nice and he's not racist against them. I think that's nice of them to do, but it's kind of a lie in my opinion, but hey, they're throwing me an olive branch, so I'm not going to deny it. You know what I mean? Like,
I mean,
sure.
Even
sure,
that other character, right, who was about to be a part of the lynching and he kind of becomes a good guy.
Oh yeah, the dumb Beckwood kid that ends up becoming dude's sidekick. Yeah, he's probably my second favorite character. I really didn't want to like that character as much as I did, but yeah, they've made you really, really like that goofy Peckerwood kid.
But yeah, the stuff in the back definitely helps, like if people are unfamiliar with the territory, I guess, like it talks. Because so one of my favorite things about the book, and we've seen this before, and I love the way this book does it, where it kind of intertwines the fantasy and the lore and mixes it with real historical events. And so they talk about kind of Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1921 and how it was destroyed. And they talk about the Red Summer of 1919, where there were like massive just displays of violence towards Black people all throughout the country, and hundreds of people died. And then, you know, Black Wall Street, where there was a small town in the middle of Oklahoma that was pretty much self-sufficient and circulated their money with each other and was really building a stable financial base, and was completely destroyed and burned down to the ground due to racism. And they take those very important and often looked over historical events and puts it in the frame of this world, right? Like they say, like, man, like, you know, my mom and dad died during, like, you know, the Red Summer of 1919. And you start to see how those events affected the family. And I really like
it's,
that.
It's kind of like I've seen other alternative history things do it, but this one is a little more honest. Like if you watched you know, something like Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, where they try to tackle these type of things and blend a little bit of fantasy into it, where like that one was kind of like, okay, well, the evil Southern guys are vampires. Like this one actually shows you these massacres that were perpetrated, and they kind of blend a little bit of fantasy to it, but it's not even a covered metaphor. They're letting you know what happened, but not being you know what I mean? Not celebrating,
right?
Trying to drag you down. They're still trying to keep it part of the story. They don't want the story to get too heavy, but it has weight.
Yes.
Which it would need to, because otherwise, why would you make a story in this time period about these kind of folks? So I really love it. And there's actually kind of a good rash of these books coming out. What's his name? Newton. I forget his last name, but Newton, the dude from Dream Theory Comics, he does a comic called Crescent City Monsters, which takes place in the 60s and is about a blues man, voodoo monster fighter that's in the same vein as this. Really good indie comic. He's got the second issue up on Kickstarter. He's one of the ones that I'm really hard, really supporting. The art in it's so good. I got a link where you could read the first issue for free, so I'll send you that after the show.
Yeah, no doubt.
And maybe we could put a link somewhere for the readers of this. So if you want to check out Newton and his Dream Fury book, that's really awesome. But yeah, back to Bitterroot. Man, Safford Green's art is just beautiful, right?
it really is. And you know it from the first page when you're inside of that Harlem club and everyone is dancing. And it's just like, man, like this kind of even looks like, he just gets the feel of the time so right. Like when you go back and look at the art from that time and the photos, it's spot on.
Right. I forget like who exactly was on the name, but I actually have seen like old jazz posters where the art actually looked like. Actually, the characters are a little more long legged and stretchy looking, but like he's got it almost completely nailed.
And yeah. And like something else I want to see too is I hope we get, because they talk about them, like you said, in the Bitter Truths, like people like Zora Neale Hurston and other, you know, historical figures from the Harlem Renaissance. I don't know like if they'll do it, because I don't know how that goes with, you know, the estates and family members who are related to them and stuff like that. But if they could be characters in the book, like I'd love to see that.
Yeah. I mean, it's tricky. I'm not sure how some books seem to get away with it, because I've read books where they talk about like Edgar Allan Poe like lived and fought Hitler. That's a new book that Ahoy put out. I forget what it's called. The Edgar Allan Poe Snifter of Horror or something like that. They could do that. I don't see. But then again, like he's not as sensitive of a character,
yeah, exactly,
of a historical figure as what you're talking about. So they would have to be tasteful. But I mean, within the parameters of the book, I think that they could find something that wouldn't make her relatives mad. You know what I mean? They could make her an advisor to the Sangre family,
right,
or something along those lines, which, you know, wouldn't be like making her into a cartoon or something.
I think it would be a good, like, I think it would be good, because it would, a lot of people don't know about, or they know about them for only one thing, you know, when really they've done multitudes of things, like especially Zora Neale Hurston. Like people know her from her book, Their Eyes Were Watching God, but she wrote so much other things, and she's actually an, what do they call those? Anthropologist. And she spent a lot of time like recording the stories and folklore of like the last surviving slaves, like right before that era of slaves was about to, like, you know, the next generation was coming in, like the first people were starting to be born outside of slavery, you know what I mean?
Right.
And,
yeah.
So their voices, she didn't want to lose their voices, and so she recorded them and got a lot of that powerful information. So it would just be cool to like see her and amongst other Harlem Renaissance figures be a part of the book. But outside of that, as you said, like, and another thing that I liked about this story too is at first I was kind of wary, like, okay, this is a story about race, but what is going to be the discussion of it? Like, what's going to be the main point here? And I think they really hit it on the nail and really knocked it out of the park, I guess, with their main villain, who isn't a white guy, right? He's he's someone who was changed not by hatred, but by pain and trauma. And I really thought that was powerful, because you have a villain who is really affected by trauma and pain, And now he is kind of becoming an antagonist to his own people almost because of that trauma and pain.
And yeah, it's changed him into a different kind of demon. Yeah, it was that was really, really cool. I mean, yeah, I mean, like the whole idea for the Ginyu were great anyways, but yeah, when you found out what was up with the bird girl and the main villain, oh dude,
And
like you.
then like how they keep extending the metaphor, like it infects the others, you know, like it infects the others, and not only does it infect the others, but people don't know what to do with it. They don't know how to deal with that problem. Like the racism and the hatred and things like that is a simple enough problem, but how do we deal with the trauma that it causes? You know, like that was
Right.
such a dope and deep metaphor. I want to read volume one again to just dig in.
I'm dying to get a volume two because this one kind of just cuts you like right off in a cliffhanger. So I'm like, I hate him for it, but at the same time, I love when books do it. Like I can't get mad at them for doing what Rick Remender does to me after every book of Deadly Class. So yeah, like. But I'm in love. I absolutely adore this book. I thought I would right off the bat. I mean, I get this when I see a new book coming out that like kind of talks to me. Like I just get an energy from it right away, and I knew right away that this one was going to be special. I think calling it fun is not doing it a disservice, but it's more than just that. Like you can read this book and have a blast, but at the same time, like there's like we pointed out, there's important history here. There are important metaphors here. It's a book that actually says that it's not just one type of people's fault, and that's good stuff to be hearing in these troubling times that we're in, man. Like that's not fingers just being pointed one way, and that's special. That's something that needs to be celebrated, and I really do hope this wins its Eisner. You know what I mean? It's a book that goddamn deserves it.
They're firing on all cylinders. Is this book currently ongoing right now, or is it on hold, or what's the status of it?
It's an image book. They never really say. I would say it'll probably go at longest 30 something issues. It might do something around 15 to 18. It's hard to tell. It depends on how much they pitched. I know the book sells really well, so is how many issues they had originally planned for it. It'll probably run whatever
Yeah.
that is, but I haven't gotten an account of that.
There's
And
second printings, I think, for all the issues.
yeah, it's a very, very well liked and read book. I mean, everybody's kind of picking it. Well, anybody that likes really good comics is picking it up.
Right. Listen, get volume one of Bitterroot if you do nothing else. It's well worth your time, well worth your money.
Yeah, it's $16.99, a little more pricey than your average image book, but you're getting a little extra story and message than you get from your normal image book. So I'd say that like you're still getting a deal.
And
You're
listen,
still getting a.
and like you said, those essays and things like that, those things are written, like those are, in my opinion, like New York Times level type, you know, pieces. Like those are like journalistic worthy pieces, I guess. Not to put one, you know, publication, but those are things worthy, in my opinion, of being published in a journal. Those were really insightful. So you get that too.
They remind me of the stuff that I read when I was in college, and I was in modern U.S. history, and I was taking African American studies in college. Like that, those the essays and that really reminded me of the stuff that was required reading for those classes. So yeah, this is on some really educational level stuff. Well, the essays in the back are. The book itself is it's a nice fantasy genre with some really good realism to it, but there's also some really, really important history at the back of the book too, which makes it a little more worth the price as well.
Absolutely.
And that's episode number three. I really had a ball doing this. Like I really like talking about these books, and I really, really enjoyed talking Bitterroot with you, Chris. That was amazing. Like I actually learned a few things I didn't know just yet. So, and I love history. I'd love to learn about all even the messed up stuff that's happened, because that's how you learn to fix shit. So thank you for all of that, and I can't wait to do the next episode. We'll have to figure out what books we're gonna do, but yeah, man, enjoy your fantasy football. That's where you're going,
about
right?
To do a fantasy football draft. But yeah, definitely enjoy talking this both books with you. I'm glad you introduced me to the first one, Death Orb, because that wasn't on my radar. So I'm glad you put it on there. Next week, yeah, we're going to come back with something. I don't know what we're going to review yet, but it's got to be something crazy. It's got to be something good.
Hell yeah.
Maybe we gotta
get
into
this.
Some of the weirder stuff.
Yeah, we got to keep this inertia going, man. We got to keep this train moving. All right, man. Take it easy. Later. Ha 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 ha!